we haven't looked at it so far. We have just started on the dependent origination of the
matter.
And these centers, what it means, we have looked at it as the causes of abhijna, why is there the abhijna. And now I want to go in the other direction. I want to look at how these other events lead to suffering according to dependent origination. I want to look at all the factors in a different detail. I did go through dependent origination already, but very quickly and briefly, and now hopefully do it in a bit more detail and do it again so that we can hopefully see what is going on here. So, we are on page 22 now. And I will read very briefly what this is saying. This is Sanyasana 12, 2001. This is a new Dharma Sanyuta. Dharma Sanyuta is Sanyuta. This is discourse about all of our dependent origination. And this is the first one that kind of defines what it is all about. So, as you expected, that ignorance is the condition for activities, or maybe intentional activities. Intentional activities are the condition for consciousness. And then you have the reverse, yeah? And the reverse is what happens if ignorance is abandoned. And so the remains of the state of mind and cessation of delusion comes the cessation of intentional activities. So the cessation of intentional activities comes the cessation of consciousness. And we have some definitions here that define the meaning of these things. And what bhikkhus are intentional activities? There are three kinds of intentional activities. Intentional activities of the body, intentional activities of speech, and intentional activities of the mind. These are called intentional activities. And what is consciousness? There are six kinds of consciousness. Eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. This is consciousness. This is how these things are defined in the sutra. And to understand things like dependent origination, you have to read quite broadly in the sutra and pull in the information from many places to understand how this actually works, what is the meaning behind this. And just to start out, the idea of sankhara. What does actually sankhara mean? Yeah? Abhijna paccaya sankhara. From the illusion comes sankhara. What does that actually mean? And I think it's quite useful to just to discuss this word a little bit. It actually has different meaning in the sutta depending on the context. And there's two broad meanings of the word sankhara. One of them, as we see here, it talks about volitional formations, which I translate as intentional activities. And this is a very important part of sankhara, is the idea of the will inside, the doer, the agency inside of us. Yeah, when we decide, we make a choice, am I going to have I had so much food on there for lunch, you know, am I going to have this one or that one or that one? Whoa, choice paralysis, too difficult. I don't know what to change. But very little ability inside of you to choose, to will one thing or the other, that's sankhara. Can we time for that choice even, perhaps? And usually in the sutras, when you read about sankhara, that is actually the most common meaning in the context of dependent origination. That is what it means. In the context of the five khandhas, that is what it means, that in the five context of the five khandhas, the will. And also other contexts as well, the majority context. But occasionally, sankhara refers to something else. It refers to those things that are actually created by the intentional activities. The things that actually are made by that. In other words, all conditioned phenomena. When we talk about conditioned phenomena, we talk about the things in the world that have been created by our intentional activities. This is basically everything. Everything in our experience, the experience that we have now, if you consider the world of experience, the experience that we have now, this experience that comes about because of volitional activities from the past. I've been born as a human being, so this is what I experienced. Come to the BDS in Malaysia. If I wasn't a human being, I wouldn't be able to come here. it is dependent on the fact that you are a human being that you can find it. Your experience depends, all conditioned phenomena around you depends on your volitional activities in the past. Sankara, the root meaning of the word, is something in the prefix. Kara is the word karoti, it means to act, it's what you make. Yeah, so it means like to act or to fabricate or to construct or to make or to create. And sun means like together. So it means almost like putting together now. Yeah, putting together things together. The creating activity is the Anya Sankara. So it means intentional activity, but those intentional activities are what actually they have a creative function. Yeah, and then that creative function, which is interesting, independent origination, because they literally then create the process that continues on in samsara, the continuation in the round of birth and death, and we'll get three aspects. That is the idea of sankara. Sankara also has other meanings as well in the sutta. Sankara it means like just the force. Yeah, and a force which drives things forward, similar to the kind of creative force for that. So it is a broad word, one of the most complex words in the sutta, but Dhamma is another one of these complex words. So sankara, and then you have avijja, delusion on the other hand. And you have this relationship between delusion and creation. Yeah, because we are deluded, we create. Because we are deluded, we act. Because we are deluded, we put things together. We start doing creative activities. I want to discuss this link one more time. And delusion here, we've been talking about avijja in many different ways. One of the easiest ways to understand avijja in the context of dependent origination, to see how it links up with sankara, is to think of it in terms of the three characteristics of existence. Avijja, dukkha, and anatta. Yeah, impermanence or unreliability, suffering and non-self. These three things. Because when we look at it from that point of view, the relationship comes out quite nicely. This is very closely related to the Four Noble Truths. First Noble Truth is all about suffering. Yeah, so the suffering part is always taken care of right there. Yeah? And anicca and anatta, impermanence and non-self, are very closely related to dukkha. Yeah, why are things dukkha? Well, they are dukkha precisely because they are impermanent. Yeah, they are impermanent, it means you can't hold, you want to hold on to things, but you can't. It just being pulled out from you all the time. And that is precisely the problem. So suffering and anicca are very closely related to each other. Anatta, also very closely related to that, because impermanence is what, impermanence is the opposite of anatta, if you like. The fact that things do not have an essence, are not kind of will carry on forever after all these things, that is why things are actually non-self. And once they are non-self, it means they're also out of control. There is nothing there which can control the world. There's no fixed pillar inside of it which always makes the appropriate decisions and all these kind of things. But these things are very closely related and they fit in with the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths being the usual definition of avijja, which is the first factor of dependent origination. So let us look at it from the point of view of the three characteristics. And as I mentioned before, when I went through this thing before, one of the biggest problems, one of the really big issues, which means that we tend to pursue often things that are not, do not lead to our happiness, is because we have this illusion that we know where happiness is to be found in the world. Yeah, we go out, we pursue things that we think are going to make us happy. We pursue a career, yeah? We work really hard on that. We pursue relationships, we get married, we have a family, all of these things. We pursue material things in the world, yeah? We want to have at least we want to be comfortable at the very least, but sometimes ideally even more than that if we can, yeah? We pursue status. Status is a very important part, I think, in our society. We think status is going to be happiness. We think status is going to lead us to some kind of satisfaction eventually. So we think we know what happiness is to be found. And because we think we know what happiness is to be found, we start pursuing those happinesses. And with that pursuit of what's happening, that is precisely what sankhara is. It's the doing, all the activity that goes into creating the happiness that we think we know is out there. But there's a problem here, right? We don't actually fully understand what happiness is, and because of that, we end up pursuing things, creating all these sankharas, but when, as a matter of fact, we're pursuing something which isn't really satisfactory at the end of the day. This is one problem, yeah? We go out and we're trying to create happiness because we think we know what happiness is. But the second problem here is that the idea of impermanence, those things that we are pursuing, they're actually much more impermanent than we realize. Yes, we know sort of at the back of our mind, we know that all of these things are impermanent. We know that sometimes you lose your money on the stock market, sometimes your relationships break up. We kind of sort of know that, but we don't fully know it. If we fully knew it, we wouldn't be so sad or surprised when it breaks apart. The very fact that we get sad when a family member dies or we lose all our money or whatever, or we get upset, it's precisely because we haven't fully internalized it. We haven't fully understood it yet. Yeah? So some of the people say, but I know about impermanence. Well, you know, but you don't know. Yeah, it's a superficial kind of knowing. It's not a deep insight into the nature of these things. So this is the other problem. We pursue these things without really understanding the problem behind them. So avijja makes us think these things are much more impermanent, much more liable to be controlled than they actually are. And that leads to the third one, the third problem of anatta. Non-self, we believe that we have far more control over things than we actually have. We believe we can sort things out, that we can, you know, let things, we can control things. If things go wrong, we can just work harder and make more money. We can control our relationships, like the career I want to pursue, I can kind of make that come about if I'm active in the right way. I can enjoy myself in the world according to what I think is right. We have this feeling of control. So that feeling of control is another illusion. The reality is that the world goes according to its own cause and conditions. And our ability to control things is far, far less than it actually feels like. It feels like we have a lot of control. Reality is far less. But it's much worse than that. And the reason it's much worse than that is because actually it turns out that this very control that we have is itself a source of suffering. And this is what I was saying before, you can see that in the meditation practice, that as you become more peaceful, as you do less, you tend to become more happier. Yeah. So we use the controller because it feels like us, because it feels like this is the real me. But actually, this thing that feels like the real me is actually itself a suffering, itself a problem. Leave it to one side, it is much better. So the whole idea of doing lots of things to create happiness is a complete mistake. It's when you stop doing things that actually happiness that can still arise. So that's why once you eliminate avijja, you realize that actually all this activity stuff is just nonsense. Much better not have any activity. Just to chill, chilling. This is part of happiness. But chilling in the kind of Buddhist sense, the deep sense, where the mind becomes very peaceful and very happy as a consequence. So all this pursuit that we are doing in the world is there because of avijja, because of delusion. The delusion fuels this pursuit. And then we do all these activities in pursuit of something which actually isn't real. It's a mirage. It's a false promise. It's something that can never actually happen. And still we run after it, try to create it. Relationships, status, material goods, all the fun in the world, all the enjoyment. Yeah, I'm going to travel here and there, yeah? I'll work really hard and make so much money, then I will go to... Not to Dhanagrava, you should be wanting to go to Dhanagrava, but you want to go to Paris, yeah? To Beijing, perhaps, and whatever else it is. These are the places you want to go there. So this is what happens. Now, when we do all these activities, yeah, to create that happiness that we think is there, these activities that we do, these intentional activities, are of various kinds. Depending on your outlook. So sometimes you do intentional activities that are because you think you're going to create a better world for yourself. And that is so important to you. If somebody else gets in your way, there's a chance that we're all finding out the promotion at work, if I want to get promoted, this other person also wants to get promoted, yeah? Okay, I'm going to put a few obstacles in the way of that other person to make sure I get promoted, and then let the boss know exactly what I think about another person. They are not as good as I am. I know that, and then let them know. Then I just start doing things that are a bit dodgy, yeah? Because of your ambition, because of your pursuit of happiness, you start to do unwholesome things. That's part of that. And then these sankhara, these volitional activities, then take on a negative activities that come from that delusion of avijja. And other times you do good things. Yeah? Other times you just realize that doing what is right is appropriate. Maybe you go to your boss and say something nice to your boss because maybe you want to be nice, but maybe also because saying good nice things to your boss is kind of helpful for your career, yeah? So it's kind of double thing that you think, yeah, it's nice to be good to be nice, but also it will help in my career, so I'll do that too. This is karma for you. Karma is always a bit gray. It is often you do things for there is a good aspect to the to what why we're doing things, but also perhaps a selfish aspect at the same time. But karma is often like gray instead of actually being either black or white. So it will all kind of work out. So in this pursuit of happiness, in this delusion, we end up doing bad things and we're doing good things. Yeah? And this is how we create karma based on delusion. From karma becomes a karma that we are creating based on the misunderstanding of reality, of where happiness is to become, all these kind of things. And of course then we can start to see what's happening now, yeah? We're creating all this sankhara, we're building up every time we do an act, every time we do an intentional activity, we are actually creating karma, whether good karma, bad karma, neutral karma, grey karma, whatever it is, somewhere in between that. Then we are building up, we are affecting our mind, affecting our consciousness as a consequence of that. This is how this whole thing kind of fits together. And then that effect on the consciousness, well, we talked about this already, is quite obvious. When you look at yourself very carefully, you will see how that works. Yeah? You do something kind, do something good, you feel good about yourself afterwards. You do something bad, you feel bad about yourself afterwards. Sometimes people carry guilt with them for years, yeah, for something they did a long time ago. I think there was a question about that before, something somebody did a long, long time ago, a couple of decades ago, and people feel guilty about it. And this is different. Part of that may just be wrong perception, but part of that is also perhaps bad karma. You've done something bad, and now you carry that on with you into the future as a consequence. So you are starting doing all of these things, yeah? You feel good about yourself, you feel bad about yourself, and you accumulate these things. And as you accumulate that, then you do a lot of good things and a few bad things. And then your mind tends to become lighter, yeah? You become happier, you become better. Your consciousness is directly affected through all these activities that you're doing. You feel light, you feel good about yourself, you feel things are heading in the right direction, and your mind becomes more contented, more light, more. Like you're a balloon, yeah? You're like a helium balloon. The more helium you have, the more uplift you have. And the more kind of light you become, and you start to soar, yeah? You feel light, and this is kind of one of the feelings of the light mind, is mind that is soaring up. At the same time, you're cutting off some of the sandbags, they used to be sandbags, to hold down the helium balloon. The sandbags are the mankama. You're cutting it off because you don't do it anymore. You don't have to forgive yourself, you don't have to let go of the past, and then you soar even more as a consequence. Your mind soars up. And this is like almost like it's like meditation practice. Yeah? When your mind soars, you also get like the bird's eye view. Now you can look down, you can see all the land. That is a bit like insight. When you soar up above the sensual pleasures, above all the ordinary things of the world, and you look down, you understand the landscape, you understand how everything fits together, how it all works out. Quite a nice metaphor for how the process works. Or if you do mostly bad things, then you're dragging yourself down in the same way. Yeah? If you are live a really dodgy life, you're a member of the mafia. Yeah. Member of the mafia here. Have you got triad, they call it in Hong Kong, isn't that right? Do you have triads in the KR? Yes, you do. Really? Ooh, okay. Any triad members there? That'd be cool if I had some triad members here. Yeah, then we're going to learn about the Dharma. That would be nice. But maybe we should invite the triad. And so that's because it's terrible, yeah? They might not even be born in one of these families. They don't have a choice, yeah? They're going to compel you to do bad stuff. Not that if you have any choice. So this shows you how hard it is sometimes to get out of samsara. You're so stuck because of that. Or for most people, you just want to carry along. Yeah? You do a few bad things, a few good things. You're kind of generally a reasonable person. It doesn't get anywhere. Your consciousness goes neither higher nor lower. Yeah? You kind of just move along kind of like this. Yeah? And then you, over here you die, over here you're born. And then when you die, you're roughly where you started out. And you kind of look back and you think, Jesus, what was the point of that? Born here, die here. Nothing really happened. It all seemed kind of like, almost like you have, seemed like you have wasted your time, perhaps. So consciousness is affected. It's very useful to feel that. Try to feel that in your own life. But how your mind is affected by the past. How your mind often is affected in the very moment by what you do. Sometimes when you do an act of kindness in the moment, yeah, you feel really inspired. Go for it, do it, and feel the consequences of that. That compassion, that kindness that comes out is often very, very beautiful. And Lord, sometimes you get this feeling, you just want to give. I mean, have that feeling, just feel like giving to anyone. It's like your heart opens up to the whole world. And when that happens, it's a very, very beautiful and powerful feeling. Notice those things. And when you have those feelings, act on them. It's a very powerful time to act. Because when you act, when you really feel like it, then the mindfulness is going to be strong. Because it's a beautiful time. You feel good. Mindfulness is going to be strong. There's joy there. Because there's joy and mindfulness together. It's very easy to remember these things in the future. It will have a very powerful impact on the mind. This is one of the reasons why it is good karma. Because a powerful impact on the mind will then be easy to recollect in the future. Like when you have a very deep meditation experience, you can never forget it afterwards. Yeah, you can't get it out of your mind. And this is part of the problem, because then you start craving for those meditation experiences. And then that craving stops you from getting there. Oh no, and kind of... but it's a very powerful thing that leaves a vast impact on you. And they can help you and push you forward and encourage you forward on the path of practice. So this is how it all links together very beautifully. Yeah, and it's very avijja leads us to do all these activities. They're not going anywhere. They're not really going anywhere. Sometimes they're going in bad places. And that those activities, because they are intentional. Remember that intentional activity, the problem with that is that it feels like we are doing them. Yeah, that's what we mean by intention. I am intentionally doing this. I am doing good. I am doing bad. And because you are intentionally doing it, you feel that you own that activity. You own the choice. Yeah, I did it. That's what it feels like. Even if this may not be true in the deeper sense of the Dhamma, it is still what it feels like. And because you have to take ownership of your actions to some extent, that is why you feel good or bad about it. I am responsible. Yeah, it is my fault that this happened. Just like they were saying the other day in the questions, you know, how can I just let go of the responsibility? Well, exactly it. You can't fully let go of the responsibility. Because the sense of self is so strong, it feels you are responsible. And then, because it feels you are responsible, that's why it has an effect on your mind and the consciousness. Lifts it up, drags it down, and makes it the same. Of course, we try to forgive ourselves. And this is one of the reasons why we reflect on non-self. Yeah? If you understand non-self a little bit, it enables you to let go a little bit. Yes, I am not fully responsible because of cause and conditions, because of my upbringing, because of schooling, because of past lives, whatever it is. So you can see that to some extent that you're not fully responsible. Yeah? If you look at it carefully, you can actually see that. But there's always going to be a residue of responsibility, a residue of feeling that it is my responsibility, I did this. You cannot let go completely unless you are a stream anchor. If you are a stream anchor, you can let go completely. And that is the beauty of being an Aryan. You But once you become an arrogant, you understand the conditioned nature of these things, but then you can let go completely because you realize that actually this cause and conditions coming together. And that's why, as a noble person, you can never be reborn in the bad realm, but because you're able to forgive yourself completely for what will happen in the past. So, our consciousness is affected in this way. Yeah, our consciousness is affected either it goes up or down, and all of these things. And then, when your consciousness is affected in this way, it means like it is kind of getting established. It gets stuck in a certain place. Yeah, it is like our mental feeling tends to be fairly stable. We have, we can get anger and upset. But you come down, you come back to a kind of level which is your ordinary level. Some people are kind of, not very happy, a bit depressed, so the level might be a bit low. Other people are quite happy people. They have kind of a high level of consciousness. Most people are somewhere in between them. That is kind of your level of consciousness. So our purpose in the spiritual life is to lift up our level of consciousness, as much as we possibly can. This is kind of one of the main reasons of it. So you can know, you can tell whether your spiritual practice, your Buddhist practice is working by seeing how it affects your mind. You should be able, over time, to feel that your mind is gradually being lifted up like the balloon soaring, That's what you should be able to feel. And if you don't feel like that, then it's good to ask yourself, why you're not feeling it? Why isn't this the case? Look over a long period of time, maybe several months, a year, a couple of years. Compare yourself now to what you were like 5 years ago. One of the mistakes people often do is they often compare themselves now to the ideal, The ideal me. And then, of course, you always feel a bit kind of despondent because you can never, your ideal here, you're never going to really get to that ideal. You don't even know what the ideal you're in. You think we know, but actually, being an arahant is probably very different from what you think it is. Yeah, we don't really know exactly what it's like to be an arahant. So instead of always looking to the future and comparing ourselves with the ideal, compare yourself with the past. What were you like 2 years ago, 5 years ago? This can be incredibly encouraging. So I look at myself, and I was like, when I became a monk, I think, Jesus, I don't want to know that fellow 20 years ago, It's got nothing to do with me. I disown that fellow who started out 20 years ago. I disown that person completely, That has not nothing to do with me, And probably 20 years past, I would say, the fellow who was sitting here talking to you, BGF in 2018, I don't want anything to do with that fellow. He forgotten about him. He was not kind of up to the standard that I now believe I have attained. So you see the change in yourself, and then you feel very encouraged. You start to understand the path is working. It's so important to look at things in the right way. Some ways can make us feel encouraged, other ways will make us feel desperate and not actually going any faster. So encourage yourself in the right way. And let your consciousness gradually elevate. And this is one of the main purposes of the spiritual path. And eventually, the consciousness is not only elevated, the whole purpose of this is to come to the point where actually the consciousness is not neither elevated nor anything at all. It is completely beyond all of these claims. And I'll talk about that later on, but that is kind of the higher purpose of it. And then, as I was saying before, then when you die, because you have established consciousness in a certain level, it is what is called the stations of consciousness in the Pali Sutra, the Vijnanapiti. Vijnanapiti is a station where consciousness is established. Then you get reborn according to that station, wherever it is. That will be correspond roughly to what we call the realms of rebirth. So if you have created life consciousness, that is where it is stationed, and the realm of rebirth will correspond to that level of consciousness that you have. And if you get reborn in a particular realm, then you will experience the world in a certain way, according to that realm. That realm will have certain limits on what you can experience. If you are reborn as a human, you can expect certain experiences as a human. Good ones, bad ones, intermediate ones. This is part and parcel of what it means to be a human being. You can expect a certain range of perceptions, a certain range of feelings, a certain range of volition, things that you are interested in, a certain range of physical form, of body and things that you see outside of yourself.
We read one as a deva, the devaloka, that range will be different. You will have more happy feelings, less painful feelings. You will perceive things in a different way. The world will look more beautiful to you because you were born in the devaloka. You will see things that are, you know, devas see rather than what humans see. So all the five khandas will have a different range in the devaloka. And this is what we mean by nama rupa, vijnana pachaya nama rupa. And when you get your consciousness is stuck at that level, that range of things that you can experience in that world, that is the nama rupa of that kind of existence. Nama rupa quite literally means name and form, but you can think and simplify that, you can think of it just as the four other aggregates apart from consciousness. Those other four aggregates will then have its kind of its limits depending on the realm that you're born in. This is how this whole thing kind of works out. And you can see the rebirth also is part of that in there somewhere. The consciousness in this life is the one that decides the consciousness in the future. Yeah, so then you're reborn at a high level. And then in the life later, you're going to be reborn at a low level. And it's like yo-yos. You're going from one life to another one like this. Sometimes happy, sometimes unhappy, sometimes in between. That's good to be like a yo-yo, right? You think that's nice? It's not nice when you go up. When the yo-yo goes up, it's really nice. When the yo-yo goes down, it's not so good, yeah? And reborn at a level, and bang, down, you become a kangaroo instead. If you're going to be reborn a kangaroo, make sure you get reborn in one another, honestly, yeah? Then it's not so bad. You get some chocolate cake every now and again. Yeah? Oh, so happy. So, that way you get reborn is such an important thing. Yeah? So this is how the whole process kind of works. Yeah? Does that make sense to everyone that's talking about? Yeah? It's strange. It took me a long time as a monk to really understand this because it is all, when you read that formula in the Tamil American kind of, it's so short, it's so brief, it's so hard to draw the meaning out. So this is one of the great things that I'm thinking about, is that you have sufficient time to contemplate these things and actually figure out what it means. But, and once you try to understand it, you realize actually it's very meaningful. Yeah? You can start to see the problem with delusion. You start to see how your activities, all the things that you do actually affect you in a very direct and immediate way. And once you start to understand this, I like the idea of understanding the big picture of things because it makes it easier to do the small, little, simple things in daily life. But don't go around carrying this around in your head because it's going to drive you crazy if you carry this in your head all the time. But use it more like, as an understanding of the broad picture of things, which then helps you in the daily life to be kind, to be generous, to do all the right things. That is the purpose of it. It's not just to create some kind of intellectual, now I can argue better with my friends about the kind of religion. That's not really the point, yeah? The point is to create something which enables you to live better, yeah? So that is the very first beginning of dependent origination. And what happened here? Okay, so just continuing on a little bit. I didn't read out the next part there. That consciousness is the condition for name and form. So the cessation of consciousness comes with the cessation of name and form. And what they use is name and form, feeling, perception, volition. Yeah, three comes out of them. Contact and attention. This is called name. The four great elements and four derived from the four great elements. This is called form. Just that this name and this form are together called name and form. Nama rupa. Nama in Pali, the word nama is directly related to the English word name. Yeah? Almost exactly the same word. They are both mean name and they both are the same word. And it's kind of interesting. Why is the word name used here? Why don't they just say the four khandhas? What is this name business all to do? Does that have to do with the Dhamma? What's going on here? And part of this is because the idea of name is one of the ancient words that was used in the Brahmanical Sutta, the Upanishad sort of thing. And sometimes the Buddha uses that terminology and gives it a new meaning in the suttas. So you have to kind of almost like he is saying this is the real meaning of these things. So you have to understand a little bit about the ancient Upanishads to understand why the word name is used here. Yeah? And the idea, I don't really fully understand, I think, why exactly it is there, but the idea that seems to be that a very important part of the mind, what we do in daily life, but to name things. Yeah? We understand the world around us in terms of names. Everything has a name. Lights. Yes, ceilings, tables, people, chairs, floors, everything has names in a sense, and it is through names that we understand the world. Everything is divided up in that way. And according to the ancient, principles of the grammatical thing, once you name something, you also have a certain power over it. Because by naming someone, it's like you are putting them in a box. You're saying, now I've got you. Yeah, I have now. If I call someone of you with a nice name, yeah, then it's almost like I have defined you. If I take a bombing, you're like a deva, yeah? That's quite nice, yeah? Like, you are a deva. I think that I have kind of put you in the deva box, and now you are defined as a deva. But by naming people, naming things, it's almost like you're controlling them to a certain extent. You're giving them limits. This is an important part of this idea of how we deal with the world around us. So this is why I think here he's using the name, this ancient principle from the Brahmanical Sutra, he's using that as a place of talking about the mental aggregates, the mental complexes. And form is just everything else, materiality around us. Yeah, forms we see, forms we feel, the body, all of this is part of the form around us. That's name and form. In other words, our experience is what it really refers to. The consciousness, which is the experiencing and the awareness, and then there's the content of experience, and it's name and form. Okay, this is pretty technical and pretty kind of a bit dry perhaps, but I hope it still makes sense to you. I should maybe get some more stories to put in there, but that's just kind of make it clearer. Yeah. But now I'm going to get even more dry, yeah? So I'm going to go from dry to super dry now. This is a very famous sutta, the Kanchanagata Sutta. And it's famous because it was later used by a very famous Buddhist philosopher called Nagarjuna. You know about Nagarjuna? Very famous philosopher, many people say he was the kind of start of Mahayana Buddhism. Others say he got nothing to do with Mahayana, he was like a Theravada philosopher or early Buddhist philosopher, and they always argue. Everybody wants to own Nagarjuna because they say he was a really kind of clever philosopher. So anyway, this is the sutta that he bases his arguments on the middle way, yeah, on this particular sutta. So for that reason it's quite famous for that reason. And if you don't understand the sutta, it's okay, you don't have to understand it, yeah. But if you do understand it just a little bit, it may be interesting to have a look at it. This is how it goes. As Sarvadina, then the Venerable Kacchanagata approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, Venerable Sir, it is said, right view. In what way, Venerable Sir, is there right view? Yeah, so now we are dealing with right view again. It has all to do with Avidya, the beginning of the path, and how that works out. This is what the Buddha replies. This world, Kacchana, for the most part, depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for the one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. This is the beginning of right view. Yeah? So, what does this mean? And what does it mean that the world depends upon the duality, the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence? These are the two kinds of standard views that we find in the world. Eternalism on the one hand, and kind of annihilationism on the other hand. What is eternalism? Eternalism is like Christianity, yeah? You die, and then you go to heaven forever after. If you are a good guy, or a good girl, if you are a bad one, then you go to the other destination, and then you stay there forever after. For it didn't want that. But this is like eternalism, this idea that things cannot carry on forever after. And that eternalism is, of course, very strongly related to the idea of the self. We read the world according to how we experience the world. We experience the self, but we project that onto the world, and we create eternality, eternalism in the world. We feel like we are here, and we feel that, and we project that onto the world, and then the world we regard the world as going on forever, eternalism, in the same way, and feel like we also are existing in the same way. This is a notion of existence. It literally refers to when something exists, it doesn't mean that it just, you know, comes and goes here for a short time. Existence has a sense of persistence in time. It is lasting, yeah? It is a real existence, not just kind of a temporary coming into being and disappearing again. This is existence in the big, kind of big frame, big way of looking at it. It really exists as an independent entity, and that's why it lasts in time in this way. This is a very common view in the world. Almost all religions are based on the idea of existence, eternalism. It was exactly the same thing at the time of the Buddha. The Brahmanical religion and later on Hinduism also is based on this idea. Brahma, yeah? The merge of Brahma and Atman, kind of the Hindu idea of eternal life after you die. Annihilationism is the modern idea that when you die, that's it then. Finished, all is gone, and there's nothing more. That's annihilationism. Yeah, and this is kind of, we sometimes think of it as a very modern idea, but actually the idea of annihilationism is just as ancient as the idea of eternalism. Annihilationism goes back to the time of the Buddha. There were already annihilationist philosophers at that time that say when you die, that's it, it's all finished. Kind of interesting, isn't it? Not that we think that we are so modern, we have the best philosophies. Actually, we're just repeating what was said 2,500 years ago. And not just 2,500 years ago, probably in dawn of history, people have already had these ideas. Yeah? These things kind of tend to recur again and again and again. So these are the two things that the world tends to rely on. Yeah? So interesting how the Buddha says here that we depend upon this duality. What does it mean that we depend upon that? What it means is that we depend upon views. We have views about things. And these are kind of the most important views that we have about the world. So we depend on that. So if someone challenges us, we will defend that view. Because our outlook, the way we communicate with others, the way we relate to the world, depends upon these views. So if you have the idea that, eternalism is right, God is there, God created us, and when we die we go to God and all these kind of things, then of course you would act in accordance with that. You would maybe pray to God that, please don't forget about me, yeah, when I die, I really want to go to heaven, or whatever it is then. Yeah, so you act accordingly, you live your life in accordance with it, go to church and all this kind of stuff. And you defend with your idea. Somebody says, maybe God doesn't exist, well, you were going to defend that to the, come to the end, that is the case. Because this is your view, and your life, in a sense, depends on that. Everything in your life, views are very close to us. If you have a sense of self, you have to have views as well. Why? Because you have to create a reality to that sense of self. The sense of self is just kind of, it's a bit amorphous, we don't really know exactly what it refers to. We think it's there, but we can't really pin it down. That's why we have views about it. The sense of self demands an explanation, it demands views. That's what's going on here. So views always exist where there is a sense of self. So this is what's going on here. The world depends upon the illusion. Yeah, we can see that is true. And one of the few exceptions is the Buddha. The Buddha actually sees things differently. So who is it that avoids this duality? And he said, he's the one who sees the origin of the world as it actually is. There is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. So how do we overcome the annihilationist view? That's what he's saying here. The way we overcome the annihilationist view is by understanding how the world comes to be. Remember what you mean by worldly.
It's the world of personal experience. Yeah,
this is my world. How does this world come to be that I experience now?
And it comes to be through craving.
It comes to be through delusion.
It is recreated again and again and again over time through rebirth, through this constant process of renewal.
When you see the force of craving, the force of delusion has to renew existence again and again and again, you know that as long as there is craving, there can be no ending of the world.
You understand the origin of the world.
You understand the origin of the experience. You understand the idea of rebirth.
But this is what this really is about.
Yeah. This is, happens when you become a stream entry.
You see the power of craving and delusion to perpetuate the existence from life to life, again and again, down the line.
That is what you see here.
Then you know that annihilation must be wrong. Annihilation must be wrong because there is a force inside of us that recreates the things all the time.
Then you have the opposite, yeah? The one who sees the cessation in the world as it really is.
He has no notion of existence in regard to the world.
So seeing the cessation of the world as it actually is means that you see that when craving stops, the world must stop.
When that creative force that drives things forward is no longer there, consciousness has no longer any place to stand.
Consciousness is lacking a place to stand because consciousness is lacking a place to stand.
There is no renewal, it is not established any particular level because it doesn't have any particular level. There is no future movement into a next life.
Consciousness stops right there.
This is why there is cessation of the world, cessation of experience, cessation of rebirth at the moment when life comes to an end.
Yeah?
There is no renewal there anymore. There is no existence, nothing that carries on beyond conditioned phenomena. Everything that stops. So this is to understand the cessation of the world, how it comes about as a consequence of the ending of craving. Yeah. That is what the Buddha is saying here. Yeah. That is why eternalism is also wrong. Yeah. So this is the Buddha's teaching. It's kind of a middle way. If the world keeps on going as long as you are creating the causes for it to go. If you stop those causes, the world comes to an end. Personal experience comes to an end. Yeah. That's the Buddha's teaching here.
So,
then the Buddha says, this world, Kacchana, is for the most part shackled by engagement, clinging, and adherence. But this one who has right view does not become engaged and cling to that engagement and clinging, mental standpoint, adherence, underlying tendency. He does not take a stand about myself. He has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising. What sees this is only suffering ceasing. His knowledge about this is independent of others. It is in this way, Kacchana, that there is right view. So, this world is for the most part shackled by engagement, clinging, and adherence. This world is people, yeah? It is us, that's what it means. We are shackled. Shackled means we are bound, we are tied, we are, that's what it means. We are tied. Tied to what? Tied to existence, tied to samsara, by all this engagement, clinging, grasping, or taking up, and adherence, holding on to things. And here specifically it refers to the holding on to views, yeah? The holding on to anything is a kind of continuation or an expression of our craving. When we crave and we attach and we adhere, that is what ties us to the world. It binds us to existence. Yeah? So we are tied to samsara, and we keep on going round and round and round as a consequence. But if you have the right view, that all that shackling, that engagement starts to fade away. You're not shackled in the same way anymore. And this is what he's saying next to you. And part of that is that you don't take a stand about myself. You don't have this notion of myself anymore. And because you have no notion of myself, it means that all these views are no longer so important for you, that all these views are kind of become irrelevant.
You don't think in terms of eternalism anymore. You don't think in terms of annihilationism, because all of these things depend on the sense of self. Yeah, and the self is what projects, makes the world into some eternal thing. The sense of self is what thinks that when I die, everything will stop. When the sense of self is taken out of the picture, then you just see causes and conditions rolling on one after the other. As long as the causes are there, things will perpetuate. When the causes are taken away, things will stop by themselves. So you are no longer shackled to the world in the same way. Once you become a stream maker, once you become an area, because myself, not the I am, is taken out of the equation. And you have no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising. What ceases is only suffering ceasing. This is really, really powerful statement. It gets to the core of what Buddhism really is about. Yeah, people often say that, when I come to the end of my life, when I become an arahant, I don't want to disappear. Yeah. But that is the problem. If you think that you're just going to disappear, it means you already misunderstood what's going on. Why? Because the Buddha says here, there's only suffering arising, suffering ceasing, that's all there is. The reason why you think that you're going to disappear is because you think you are there to begin with. But if that is an illusion, if the sense of self is an illusion, then all there is a time aggregate, and the time aggregate the Buddha says is suffering. So there is a problem. And that is all there is, that sense of self is just something that gets in the way and blocks our view of seeing things according to reality. It's all the suffering arising, suffering ceasing. Once you get that, of course, you're going to say, gee, it doesn't matter whether I'm there or not to enjoy it afterwards, let's just get rid of the suffering, because you're not there anyway. There is nothing gets lost in this process. That's kind of hard to see, isn't it? This is why this is incredibly profound now. For those of you who now, at this point, want to leave here and kind of go back home and say, I've had enough of Buddhism, I can understand that, right? I can sort of get that, because this feeling is profound. There's only suffering arising, only suffering ceasing. But once you get that, it is so freeing and so liberating, because then you can let go of everything. There's nothing that you need to hold on to anymore. Moment to moment in your life, it is the suffering arising, suffering ceasing. From life to life, it's suffering arising, suffering ceasing. Yeah, and this is really the kind of the nature of existence, says the Buddha. It's very difficult to see fully, and initially you can, if you don't think it's true, well that's fine, you don't have to kind of, you shouldn't take these things on board, you find it very hard to understand it. If you find it very hard to understand, just let it be, leave it on one side. Just take it as a teaching that is there in the sutta, but difficult to really get a hold on that. And then allow it to grow with time. And maybe after a while, you may actually be able to understand these kind of profound teachings. They're very interesting because they are such incredibly different outlook from how we normally look at the world. And again, it's important to understand this in the context. This doesn't mean that there is no happiness. There is still happiness. But from a higher perspective, even that happiness is not really worthwhile. That's what the Buddha said. When you feel incredibly happy, yeah? You gain the first deck of samadhi, the Buddha said, no, not good enough, there's something better there. This is kind of the miracle of these teachings. But, this kind of a sutta, if you kind of get people who are absolutely new to Buddhism, none of you are absolutely new, I should have answered before I kicked off this sutra. Don't teach this to someone who is an absolute beginner, yeah? Because they will be completely flabbergasted when they give you kind of sutra. Whoa, what is this? Yeah, it takes kind of, you have to contemplate this for 20 years before you kind of start to get your head around this kind of thing. So all this suffering arriving, suffering deeply. There's a nice sutra, there's a bhikkhuni, a nun called Vajira in the Bhikkhuni Samyutta. And she kind of, Mara comes to her and says, yeah, what are you doing? Go back to daylight, you Bhikkhuni, what are you trying to kind of escape me? You can't escape me. And she replies to him in verse. And when she replies in verse, she replies something very similar, almost back to this one here. She said, well, there is no being here, there is no Bhikkhuni. All there is something arising and something ceasing. Yeah,
have to be home and it's goodbye tomorrow, and then Mara kind of gets it, yeah, okay. He has been confounded and he kind of disappears after that trip. The victory knows me, and Mara says, okay.
So that is the all the suffering, you have no doubt, the perplexity, yeah? Because you have seen this for yourself, that only suffering arises, suffering ceases. And his knowledge of that is independent of others. You have direct insight into the Dhamma. You know what's going on. Nobody, that's why the three mentors will never tremble or feel anything, yeah? Because they know things directly. You can challenge them as much as you like to. And it's not going to change an iota of the way they look at the world. Because this is direct experience at this particular point. All exists, asana. This is one extreme. All does not exist. This is the second extreme. In other words, eternalism, annihilationism. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle. This is another way of looking at the middle way. With ignorance or delusion as condition, there are intentional activities. From intentional activities come consciousness, etc., all the way up. And so this is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Then when that ignorance or the delusion fades, then you get the cessation of the volitional activities, intentional activities. And then from the cessation of the intentional activities, you have the sensation of consciousness. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So, that is the famous Kacchanagoka Sutta. And if it is a little bit foggy to you exactly what it means, don't worry too much about that. Because I would be really surprised if everyone of you got this perfectly exactly what it means. Because it is obviously, we're talking about some of the most profound suttas in the Pali Canon. It's not easy to understand exactly what these things refer to. So, that's it for now. Let's have a short break. And let's come back again at 3 o'clock.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.